Thank you very much, Leon. So first of all, I would like to thank you for inviting me to such a famous place. So I'm quite pleased to be here. And I'm sure in office with George Zawadzki, so hopefully some wisdom will sort of penetrate in my head as of this morning. Yeah, he's not here, so that's why I'm saying it. Hopefully it doesn't go into recording. Well, okay. Anyways, I'm an experimentalist, and I'd like to sort of talk and sort of get you encouraged and going in this sort of, sorry for this word again, emergent area of interest. It's called interface of strongly correlated systems, what I'm interested in, but in general, complex oxides. So this is the short plan of my talk. It really doesn't reflect everything, but those are big topics. I'll be talking about what's really interesting in oxide interfaces. And I'll say really like three, four words about how we fabricate it. Don't worry, it's really like two, three slides, but you will get an idea why we think we finally reached this stage where we can control the materials on atomic scale. So it should give you some reassurance that the materials we're working on, they're not as dirty as they used to be, like say 5-10 years ago. The experimental results I'm going to be talking about has been acquired almost exclusively at the synchrotron facility, third generation. I started to work at the ASRF in France, and then we moved to Argonne National Lab, and that's where we've got majority of the data. And also we did neutron scattering at ASRF, at ILL, but still in the same place in Grenoble. And at ISIS in UK. So then I will talk a little bit about this summary, if it's possible to make this such a summary, and I want to talk about future directions as well. I have more, of course, to tell and more systems to expose, but today I'm going to focus only on one. And if somebody finds this interesting or would like to sort of continue on, I could, you know, we could discuss more afterwards. Okay, so feel free to interrupt me anytime you sort of find that something is strange and it doesn't make sense. I'll try to answer it, come up with some plausible sort of argument, at least. So first of all, I'd like to acknowledge the people I worked throughout this for the past 4 years on this project. I started as a postdoc, and we developed a very good friendship with John Freeland and Gerald Kovich and the Advanced Photon Source. Essentially, John, as you will see in majority of papers, he will be either second or first author. And Bernard Keimer, he's here is not because he is a director or something. He really contributed a lot intellectually and funding-wise. Genyat Khaliulin, he had some interesting ideas about theory, which we implemented in some of the papers. Habermeyer and Alexander Boris. Habermeyer is in charge for fabrication in Max Planck, and Alexander Boris is instrumental in infrared optics. Michel Van Endel, he is sort of our latest collaborator, and he did some interesting cluster calculations, and I'll share at the end of my talk. Tim Charlton, Robert Douglas, they from ISIS, they helped with neutrons, and Jean-Marc Tonner and Stefan Grenier. Those people, they work at CNRS, where we do a lot of now scattering, not only the absorption, but scattering experiments. But that's a new stuff, too. Honorin Lee from Oak Ridge, he helped a lot to start new topics in fabrication. And Min Xiao and Shui Liu, they second harmonic generation people. And this is my group, actually, even though I've been at Arkansas for a year and a few months. I already have a postdoc, and those are my PhD students. They actually very aggressively work on the fabrication. We have full blast going right now, so we're not waiting for anybody. We supply samples actually now around the world, so I'm proud of that. And some new stuff is coming out too. So, but that's all in the experimental part. Also, these people must be mentioned because they influenced me enormously, starting with George Zawadzki when I read his very early papers, and then I read Daniel Komsky paper in Uzbek Fizhicheskikh Nauk in Russian, and then where I learned what the Yantler distortion is, how important that. And then Andy Millis and, of course, Satoshi Akimoto, those are really the people I'd like to talk a lot when they talk about electronic reconstruction and theory insights. So thanks a lot for this kind of things. It's important for us. Because I really like to start very simple with a complex oxide, it's almost like a sort of advertisement for what's important today, at least to me. The superconductivity is, of course, this is the sort of enigma of modern condensed matter physics. That's how I view it. That's a crystal structure of YBCO. We'll be talking a lot about the YBCO. This is the transport measurement here. So all of a sudden, when you see the resistance goes down at certain temperatures, here it's about 80 Kelvin, then you know this material perhaps is superconductor, perhaps. So the magnetism is very important too. Colossal magnetic resistance manganites, that's sort of the CMR material, is very important as well. I think we have pretty good understanding now how this stuff works, unlike high TC materials, but that's also part of complex oxides. And the newest interest in the community, of course, are ferroelectrics and multiferroics. I intentionally will stay away from that because at the moment I wouldn't be sort of attributing them to the class of strongly correlated materials, but I could be wrong. Okay, so why complex oxides? This is again, sorry for a naive introduction, maybe it's more for students than for experts. In the metallic ferroelectric, you know, you can use the free electron gas description, you can throw some Hamiltonian with some small interactions, and then you perhaps could calculate the properties of the materials and predict the ground state, and that's fine. However, in the case of complex oxides, that doesn't work too well because the free electron model, when you throw with lots of various interactions, that doesn't give you a proper ground state in most cases. So the perturbation will fail, and we need something different and bigger and better, but usually we end up with some phenomenology. But the interesting thing is, you know, even if we can't properly calculate every single feature, we at least could try to discover some new phenomena, either theoretically or experimentally. So the ground state, what's important here, the point is the ground state is created by competing interactions. That's sort of the key. So you could think of the kinetic energy versus potential energy, delocalization versus localization, metal versus insulator, all these kind of things. They driven, and that's what I put in red, and I'll say why in a second, the small energy chain can really shift the balance in either of those sort of ground states. Now, why I put it in red? So if I start talking about the oxide interfaces, that's because people say, why you do that kind of thing? And that would be the answer. So the hope, for at least for an experimentalist, is that at the interface, because we break the symmetries and because the electronic properties are perhaps different, we could modify those interactions. At the moment, we don't know the rules. What happens if I bring this and that? What's going to happen? But the goal is, can I modify the couplings? Okay, and that what perhaps will sort of will give a good idea. So if you read the historical sort of reviews of how high TC materials being sort of studied, that the goal at that time was to modify electron phonon coupling, and that's what people tried to do through doping that kind of thing, and that's what's come out. So the idea here is the same. We're not using any doping, but the idea is that perhaps the interface could be used as a holy grail for modifying the couplings. And that may reveal some new physics. Okay, so I'll give you some examples what happened recently. And I think everybody knows now about this early work done by Ahmada. That's when people took the MOT insulator, it's a lanthanum titanate, and brought together with bent insulator. And then sort of a boring thing, having one insulator, another insulator, by different reason, of course. This is a wide band gap. This is not the reason for that. And what they ended up, that depending on the interface, how they break this plane, but the major thing, they ended up with metallic interface. So this is a little bit of was a scary at that time, because how come you have two insulators and all of a sudden you ended up with pretty good metal? Because if you just don't know what's inside, but except you know there's a two insulators, you stick four contacts and that do four proper resistivity, and all of a sudden it's highly conductive.
That's a deep point, actually. I think that it's actually not really important that this contact is not transparent.
That's right. That's mixed valency, essentially.
It would be exactly the same if you take, say,
not platinum, diamond,
but platinum, aluminum, for
instance. Oh, not quite. The aluminum doesn't take any oxidation states, right?
Exactly. That's, you have to worry about compatibility, about compatibility, and so on. But generally speaking, the fact that it's not one of its counterparts of the MOT insulator for this particular phenomenon, I think it's completely erroneous.
I would agree with that point. The point here, perhaps, if I put it naively, right, without going, if, of course, you can ask Milis and Nakamoto, we'll give you a big theory. But if you naively ask experimentalists, you have to have an ion, transition metal ion, which accept different mixed valence, so essentially should have different valence states.
Yeah.
And that's a mixed valency, which, of course, that's the signature of a metal. Okay? So that perhaps would be the...
You can also think of some transition metals which also can accept different valence states.
Right. Now, let me just point that that's sort of like a very good understanding. However, people try experimentally. And that's what's surprising. The number of systems where you can generate metallic interface is actually extremely limited. So that's another interesting question. Why is it so? It sort of looks like, you know, let's take a couple of materials, like say titanium manganese, and okay, the titanium is better here because it takes 3+, 4+, and we'll generate mixed valence, which is metallic state. But it doesn't work that way, naively at least.
You want to get into the political question of nanodotes, something titanite also being...
Yeah, yeah. If you would like, you know, we actually studied in my group quite extensively, and in fact, we've done a lot of measurements now.
It's possible, I guess, at the interface that one just has lanthanum dope, strontium titanate, which is also a metal, rather than.
Whether it's in pure electronic or simply just
lanthanum. I mean, material. It depends who you ask, right? For people who already published something, it's not, right, anymore. But for people who just fabricated and didn't publish in high-profile magazines, that would be the open question, right? So, you know, as you know, a French group would be arguing that's the bulk property, essentially generated lots of defects, on the microscopically, really. And of course, the people like the other group would claim that purely interfacial phenomena. I belong to the group of people who would claim that's the not interfacial phenomena, and we've done experimental investigation of that, shown that's the case. However, it is not only interfacial. I think they're both contributing, and it's hard to separate those two. Okay. But if you'd like to discuss, we could talk, and I could show experimental data on that. Now, the quantum Hall effect has been reported very recently in this magnesium doped zinc oxide. That's very interesting. It is not a strongly correlated system, but the reason I put it here is because the first time I think we reached the level when I can say the quality of the interfaces is very, very good. Because you understand, in order to end up with the quantum Hall effect, the two-dimensional gas got to be absolutely clean. And that's very hard to achieve. And the first time it's been shown, the oxide interfaces are good now. So last time I checked, I think it was in Science Express, but I'm pretty sure it's already propagated in Science because it's been like for a month or more. Now, that's the question Nicola asked me about this lanthanum eliminated strontium titanate. Without going in debate, I want to say it's what's been reported. The Mannhardt's group from Germany, of course, reported the metal insulating transition. So what they took this like strontium titanate as a thick substrate. They deposited different thickness lanthanum eliminated layers on the top, and they monitored the conductivity here as a function of thickness. So the number of unit cells is here. The conductivity of the whole thing is plotted there, and y-axis. So as you notice, like once the thickness of this layer dropped below 3 unit cells here, there is a metal insulating transition occurring, right? And that's a room temperature actually result. Now, the same system has been used by the group from David Blank from the University of Twente in Netherlands when they reported, of course, the Conde phenomena. And the group from Geneva University, Triskanen, and the collaborators, they reported the presence of superconductivity. So you may also then continue on and argue, where's the ferroelectricity here? Because it seems to me got the whole slew of physics sitting inside. But anyways, it shows the phenomena is unusually rich And one should try to understand what drives this kind of effects. I tried to make a list of things from the experimentalist point of view, what could be important, how can you use that? And I started with the simple sort of concept, the atomic relaxation reconstruction. That came apparently from the surface science, right? People know like silicon reconstructs, oxide interfaces, surfaces also reconstruct. That's now known. It's more rare, but they do reconstruct. And so you would expect that the atomic positions of the interface not necessarily the same as in the bulk. So that could be an important factor. So this lattice reconstruction is an important factor. Now, another favorite game experimentalists would play and the theorists would try to explain, so how can we use this train to induce electronic reconstruction? And the idea is quite simple. So you take a substrate with a lattice parameter of a certain size, let's say 3.9 angstrom, and then you try to deposit like few atomic layers of a material which has either shorter or longer lattice parameter. And then you would expect, since it's a epitaxial growth, that's supposed to stretch the lattice of the material you're trying to grow. But that's not only that, because stretching bonds, and that's supposed to change your physics. We're talking about transition metals, transition metal oxides. So that strain control could be very important, and that's been a favorite toy in the manganese. So especially Japanese researchers, they showed quite remarkable results could be achieved by applying growing the lanthanum strontium manganese, praseodymium strontium manganese oxides on the different substrates. The other, of course, favorite toy for experimentalists, and we just seen the examples, is to look at the polar interfaces. But again, that concept came from surface science. Because it's a simple thing, you know, once you break the translation and symmetry, you understand the bonds cannot be just dingling in the space, and it's supposed to somehow find a partner to make some kind of new bonding, which will change the structure. And then typically, for example, if you take like simple perovskite strontium titanium O3, you try to grow it in one direction, you will end up with, say, for example, a plane of oxygens, which is impossible to have, right? You understand nature wouldn't allow you to have like oxygen two minus interface or surface. So there has to be a reconstruction. So that kind of effect's been studied quite extensively recently, and Nicola would know much more about that kind of effects, and Andy Millis has done also work in this direction. So this is the electronic reconstruction. This is the new area we try to explore. I call it topological spin rearrangement. It depends how you would like to call it. So the idea here is simple. If you take just a cubic structure, some perovskite with cubic structure, and you attach the spins like at each node antiferromagnetically. So it's a perfect antiferromagnet. And then you look at the 1-1-1 direction, then you will be astonished to notice that's actually not an antiferromagnet anymore. It is a ferromagnet. So the idea was, what if I grow those materials on a substrate which is 1-1-1, and it will just continue growing another material on the top of that, which is not, which is antiferromagnet, would it become a ferromagnet because of this special topological rearrangement? And that's true, it does work that way. Unfortunately, the magnetic moment is absolutely tiny. It's really more like a counted antiferromagnet than the perfect antiferromagnet, even though visually it's supposed to be a good ferromagnet.
Wait a minute, what do you have in mind?
You could
also cubic.
You could also cubic.
If you grow also cubic, then this layer from other material would be also ferrite, would be quite good.
Yeah, but
if
they're exactly the same, right? But if the magnetic moment per site is not the same, then you're going to end up with some net magnetization, and it doesn't work that way.
Okay. That was me.
Yes.
But note that actually this ferro layer doesn't the counterpart doesn't like to be also in parallel.
No,
maybe
no.
Maybe also speak parallel, but different insight.
Yeah, different nouns. Yes, that's the idea. Yes.
But you also on the surface, so on the interface, you break inversion symmetry.
That's correct.
So you don't expect just normal fair or unfair structure. It's very natural to expect some kind of an orbital symmetry.
As I said, I'm aware only about two sort of systems people try. There is one work done by Kawai, which published in Science, and our work done in the direction. So, yeah, I agree with that. So the naive understanding, as we thought, it doesn't work that way. Apparently, there is some reconstruction at the interface.
What were the systems that
have been done? We've done lanthanum ferrite with lanthanum chromate. Lanthanum iron O3. They're very simple. Lanthanum iron O3, lanthanum chromium O3, and then we've done lanthanum iron O3 and lanthanum manganese O3. We have experimental data, so if anybody's curious, I would be happy to share these results. We've done one unit cell thickness, thick layer. Each layer is one unit cell thick, 1-1-1 direction. We actually have 1-1-0 direction, which is also very interesting to look. That's different. That's correct. That's correct.
The distance may be more difficult.
Yes.
So bottom distance then 1-1-1 would be also different.
Correct. Okay, so this is another direction I encourage the theorists to have a look in that. Here's the what you see in blue here is what I'm going to be talking about a lot today. It's about the effects of charge transfer, or some people call it charge leakage. I will be sticking with this term, charge transfer. And another important, this is simple, right? So you take two materials with different work functions, they are supposed to equalize.
In charge transfer, charge leakage is not the same. Let's say polar interfaces and different things. You mean something else?
Yeah, I would mean something else here. They could be related, but here I will see there are details which sort of differentiate this from that. Yes, in this direction. And this is the topic, as I said. This is a result. I'm glad to report here. I'll be talking about the first, I would think, solid experimental evidence for orbital reconstruction and. Hybridization at the interface of strongly correlated materials. So that's sort of at the end of my talk, one third of my talk. Okay. So, but those effects are very hard to take into account, especially this part. And I'll show you what we would be interested to hear from theorists. How can you handle this kind of phenomena? Okay. So. What I'm going to be talking, most of it's, the biggest, largest part of my talk will be about this system. And that's, and as I said, to us, we're very adventurous people, so we decide not to look at a simple perovskite. We decide to go full blast and explore what happens when you have two materials with completely antagonistic order parameters in the bulk. So we started with the high-temperature superconductor YBCO, and we throw the ferromagnet, lanthanum calcium manganese O3. We create super lattices made of these two materials, and the question is what kind of properties we're going to end up. And the other system, I was going to say something about that, but then I realized perhaps it will take me too much time. But if somebody's curious, we have very extensive now a set of experimental data, but it's a non-Fermi liquid metal calcium ruthenate with the classic anti-ferromagnet calcium manganite. So it's a metal meets the insulator. So it's very interesting to see what happens at the interface. And again, those are materials with 1, 2, 3, and so on unit cell thickness. Okay. And the result, believe me, unexpected. So it would be interesting if you internally ask yourself what would be the magnetic property of this thing. Calcium ruthenate, by the way, it's a paramagnetic metal. Okay, so.
Can you also do the same with transfer
ruthenate? Yes. So, transfer ruthenate, we actually have very good handle on transfer ruthenate. And in fact, it's one of the topics I'm interested in is to look at the work we've done. You had some predictions on transfer ruthenate, STO, and transfer ruthenate, right? Which is not very difficult to fabricate, in fact.
Right.
Yes, so experimentally, it's not a challenging system. It takes some work, but we have good handle. We've done transfer with an aid in this context. So as a replacement for this ferromagnet.
I think that is what you feel. No, I saw that instead of the custom net custom magnet, this transfer magnet.
We have not done the system itself, but we grew the transfer ruthenite. We know how to grow it. That sort of.
We didn't try it yet.
We didn't try it yet. Okay, so I will say a few words about the fabrication, sort of like if for theorists perhaps it's sort of interesting to look how those people do it, and I will be talking about the my machine and we use a technique called laser MBE. Sometimes people call it pulse laser deposition, but we took a step further. We have now atomic layer control over what we do. It's not just simple pulse laser deposition. So I have a little cartoon produced by Honuan Lee from Oak Ridge, so we'll go over that. But first, I'd like to say what's important, what's real breakthrough. It looks like a very strange thing to talk about atomically flat crystal of strontium titanate, but that was essentially a breakthrough because this crystal, this substrate, is a workhorse for most of the superlattice as people fabricate these days. And before about 1987, people actually could not make this material atomically flat. The most bizarre thing, the way you prepare this atomically flat surfaces, you see the step size here. This is the whole scale here is a 2 micron. And there are huge steps here, the large terraces. And the width of the terrace here is really macroscopic. But the height of each terrace here, the step height, is 390 picometers. So it's a half unit cell, essentially, here. So the way it's done is that it's a chemical treatment. We have, in my lab, we have full chemical treatment facility set up here. And we do it like routinely. We can actually do like several a day. It's not a big deal. But that was actually a breakthrough done by Kawasaki's group and published in Nature, how to chemically treat substrates. So then what we
do...
What's that?
How is it checked?
It is a CFM image. This is atomic force microscope image, and there is another way we look at the reflected electron diffraction on the surface. So we do statistically and locally. It is really checked and by numerous groups. It's become routine. It's a routine which is like people don't question anymore. But again, I'm saying don't count that you can do it with any substrate. Strontium titanate actually has a special sort of features which people explore in chemistry. Anyways. So what do we do next? We'll take the heater, so we can warm it up to 1,000 centigrade. We touch this substrate once it's prepared with beautiful steps, so you could deposit here your beautiful material with the. Because remember, if you have any wiggles here, then you put one or two atomic layers, they will propagate. Essentially, they just break your crystal. You'll get mixed termination in your crystal, and that's what we're not interested. So we glue it here. Or we touch it any other way, we warm it up to a certain temperature, and then we fill up this chamber with the oxygen under high pressure. So it's 200-300 millitorr pressure of oxygen. So it's highly oxidized because what happens here is what's important in this oxide game, why the MBE people have this such a huge trouble, the conventional MBE people, when they do it. They cannot control oxygen because MBE requires ultra-high vacuum. And that's a contradictory statement. On one hand, you want to have ultra-high vacuum. On the other hand, you need oxygen. Because oxygen, there is no solid oxygen. You cannot build it. You cannot buy a cell with, say, okay, here's another oxygen source. You have to have oxygen near the sample. And so they go on all sorts of strange troubles to trying to prepare that. But it's very hard for them. For us, it's easy. It's really nothing because we're not using equilibrium growth. We're using a highly non-equilibrium process, and you will see we're using laser, which shoots at the target. This is the mirror here. So there is a pulse here which delivers about 2 joules per 20 nanosecond. And essentially what it does, it ablates the material here producing plasma, and that plasma gets back. It touches here the substrate, and the growth is typically 0.1 to 0.3 angstrom per pulse. Then we could change the target and put, say, here we put YBCO, here we put the target made of manganese, here we put the target made of ferroelectrics, and we just essentially rotate them and doing this 10 pulses here, 20 pulses there. So it depends on the growth rate, too, right? And ablation rate. And because we have no trouble with it, because laser beam is extremely energetic, we can fill up the chamber with any gas to any pressure, and we really just control oxygen very easily.
Is it known, is there any kind of systematic differences in defect nature and defect profile between laser MBE and conventional MBE because of the energetic differences?
It is known that the laser MBE would produce many more defects compared to the conventional. Yes, because this is extremely non-equilibrium growth and very fast, as you can notice. So if you want, we can grow essentially the hundreds of nanometers within like 100 pulses or something like that. Within a few minutes, you can. But that's not normal. So they, of course, built element, you know, the material element by element. So they buy the cells, like they wanted to do strontium titanate, they buy strontium, they buy titanium, but they don't have oxygen. So they put ozone near the sample and they essentially just evaporate it, and the strontium would get on the substrate. Then they take titanium, bring it there, and then they would just sprinkle a little bit of ozone, so making sure that that's sort of, but that's the trouble, right? You have to essentially build the chemical formula. Here we don't build anything. If we need strontium titanate, we buy target made of strontium titanate and essentially ablated. So we transfer the advantage of laser MB, we do the stoichiometric transfer of the whole chemical formula essentially here. If
you can't do this at low MB, you have to basically blow up your target.
Essentially you have to make a plasma here, right? That's right. So that's why you have this two joules and that kind of thing. But there is advantage, right? So because if you have such an energetic beam here, then you can fill up with any oxygen, or if you want to put argon or nitrogen or whatever you like. That's right. So that's what I thought is important, that you look at how it's done. So this is UV laser. Essentially, it's bigger than this table, that high. You know, it cost about 120,000. That's like 1/5 of my startup went only in laser. But it operates on 248 nanometers. But that's what it does. UV absorption is extremely strong. By the way, you could put your finger if you would like, and it will just itch you a little bit because there is no absorption on the skin. It's carbon and hydrogen. Okay. So that's how it works, and that's how we do the deposition. Okay, so...
You never break up the polymer unit?
No, you do, and very many times. And so essentially, why? Otherwise it would be like push-button facility, right? Finding the proper condition in the phase diagram, which includes oxygen pressure, laser density, and essentially you could have the growth rate. That, because it depends on nucleation, how quickly you put the atoms on the surface. That's very daunting task. That's not straightforward. That's what the exploration goes. Essentially, we do the mapping. We grow many, many samples till you find the proper thing. Okay, so that's what we've done. We decided to, by the way, the system I'm going to be talking about, it took about 2-3 years, actually, to perfect the growth in the Max Planck Institute before I came there. But Habermas' group actually done quite a good job with that, growing manganese and YBCO, and then I learned how to grow the superlattices with their help. So we started with lanthanum, calcium, manganese, O3, and you know that has very, very diverse phase diagram depending on the doping level here. I'll be talking about doping level here on the level 1/3. So essentially it's 2/3 of lanthanum and 1/3 of calcium. So every third atom will be substituted here. And that becomes ferromagnet at certain temperatures, like around 250 or something Kelvin. And then we bring together the YBCO. And again, depending on the stoichiometry, you could have anything you want. And here we're trying to stay in optimally doped regime, so the TC in the single layer will be around 80 Kelvin, so we tried to make it as best as we could. And the question is, what do we have? And this is the low resolution TM, so it's 100 nanometer scale, so it shows essentially how these layers look like. The individual thickness of the layer will be 100 angstrom, which that's what we're interested in and we'll be talking about. And here it just shows that there is the planar growth as expected. And that's the actually most complex superlattice to date anybody's produced with this mutually incompatible order parameters. So then you have to do the transport, right? So we've done, this is resistance versus temperature. And as you can see, here's the first metal insulating transition in the manganite. Then when you drop the temperature around 78 Kelvin, here you see the clear transition to superconducting state. So we know we got both. This is metal insulating transition from manganite, and we got superconductivity. from YBCO. Here's a squid measurement. This is magnetization. So we apply small field, and of course manganese saturates as it should. So it's a ferromagnetic right there. And also, if you do it in zero field, diamagnetism from superconductivity kicks in. So you have strong diamagnetic response, which is signature of superconductor. So you got both. Yes, please.
What type of superconductivity do you have? I mean, basically, the question aims at, is it, if it is thin film, then I know, if I have some knowledge about the thickness of your superconductivity layer, you know, the Markey-Thompson type of analysis would tell you a certain scaling with the thickness. So then I would know it's a thin film. Superconductivity could be different. I mean, my question is, do we know what type of superconductivity we have in the system?
I mean, it's
thin film.
Oh, what we can say from thin film, so this is actually not thin film from my point of view, that we still fucking 100 angstrom, it's 8 unit cells. But here, the TC, first of all, you judge by TC and the width of the transition, right? So by judging by TC, it's about 80 Kelvin. So it's suppressed, but the thickness is small, right? So then you expect suppression of superconductivity with thickness. Also, if you do XRD, you know, the C-axis parameter in the X-ray diffraction scales with oxygen content. From that C-axis parameter, you can actually tell what your oxygen. Tranquad has done that quite good measurement of that. So we're confident that it's nothing really particularly special in here. And if apart from the interface, 100 unit cell YBCO is not really something special. Okay, so it's. Yeah, it's fairly close to bulk, and the suppression of TC from 94 happens only because of the thickness effect. Okay. So, but judging by this sort of observation, we would say this is not something outstanding. Not different from bulk, I would say. Okay, but the question is, okay, if it's like that and they're both present, then what happens at the interface? Because that's sort of the main interesting topic here. And I'm showing to you now like a little bit higher resolution TEM. This is the transmission electron microscopy, and this is 4 nanometers. You can actually see, because the unit cell of WIPCO is so large, you can see a unit cell here. The unit cell of manganite is pretty small, so you can't really see it. But you can see very coherent interface. So those are layers by layers. There are no defects, no destruction, nothing. But of course, it's a local point of view. You can't judge that the whole sample like that. But it's a randomly picked thing, so we think it's representative of the material. And plus, you can do lots of other measurements, and I'll prove that it's a very high-quality material. So the question is if that's the bulk and that's the bulk, then what happens here? And very naive, I think only an experimentist would say that kind of thing. That's sort of like what you expect. There is a one-order parameter here when you go to, say, to 10 Kelvin. How did they survive? So this becomes ferromagnet, clearly. This is superconductor. So the Cooper pair would like to be like this, and the ferromagnetic coupling is like that. The ferromagnetic coupling always wins because it's on the level of Joule. Sorry, it's on the level of Kelvin, and there's a millikelvin. And then this thing is supposed to really win, and yet they coexist. And we were puzzled because it was clear that the interface chemically is very coherent. And yet the properties did not indicate anything specific that manganite or YBCO would be any different if we look at the bulk. So we decided to look at this material microscopically. So first of all, we studied this material with the neutron scattering, and that's again very short sketch for people who are not doing this kind of measurement. That's very important if somebody's talking about that, so you know what it is. This is what scattering done in Grayson angle, no different from reflectivity with the regular light. So the neutron wavelength here is really it's like light. And you just put in a Grayson angle, your diffractometer, and you just measure you're trying to find the break peak, some break condition depending on the bilayer thickness, you'll get this break peaks. Okay, so this is not diffraction. Again, we're not looking inside the unit cell. We're looking at the reflection of the interfaces because there is another super period, this lambda. And of course, you can get this, as I call the Bragg reflection, not Bragg scattering peaks. Okay, and you can get this in the specular condition when this minus that matches the inverse, the reciprocal lattice parameter, you get this Bragg reflection. And you get first order, second, and so on, so forth. Of course, you can vary now the angle here, so take it out of plane, and that will give you off specular condition. And if you stay in plane, this is Qx, Qz. That gives you a specular peak, so it's elastic essentially scattering or elastic reflectivity. Now, what's important is to remember whatever you see in the Q space is if it's small, then it's big in real space, right? It's 2 pi over that, and vice versa. So that's important, we'll see in a second. That's what we've done. So we decided to look at that because that gives you information right off the interface. Because this reflectivity, what happens to the interface? And neutrons, they have magnetic moments, so they really could pick up some magnetism, and plus they can tell a lot about structure as well. So we've done it, and here's the result. So went to LL, and I'll take you through this exercise. And so here's a 300K, we see the break peak, as it should be. That's a structural break peak. So you see super period, you can conclude how thick is your sample out of that. So we started cooling. You will see, first of all, the intensity of this break peak goes up when you below the magnetic transition. So this is the structure plus magnetism. That's what you expect. Then there was a strange, unexpected peak at around 90 Kelvin. It took us a while to figure it out, but we'll skip it because it's actually related to this structural phase transition in this transept Titan at around 105 Kelvin, actually unrelated to physics of the superlattice. But it took quite a time to prove it. But anyways, there is a small sort of broadening here. And then the most spectacular thing occurred when we dropped just below superconducting transition. At 105, at 78 Kelvin, just below, I have a sequence of that thing. I've shown something. All of a sudden, this break peak collapsed. It became extremely broad. And second important thing, it developed this pattern. It looks like stripes. You should be immediately sort of excited looking at the stripes, and that would be it. And I remember, like, we were sitting in the cabin and started trying to calculate quickly what's the size of the stripes. And then you can see when you just go below, you know, to the base, that's the lowest temperature we could reach at ISIS in UK. When we reach 10 Kelvin, you see this pattern gets broader and broader. Now, I would like to put in your head, if it's broad here, it means in real space it's getting like smaller and smaller. Okay. No. Does every interface give you the its diffraction pattern, right? So it's a diffraction or reflection of each interface. Okay. So what you really see now in this map, that's the action map of the interface. Presume that they're all the same. So that's really the Q space representation of the interface. If I could solve phase problem, I could invert it and tell here is the interface. So we got excited. However, I would like to explain what we found later. So if you look at the numbers and try to calculate, then there will be a big disappointment first. And I showed to you the Kerr microscopy image. So it's a real space image of the same interface. But I'm bringing attention to the size of the image, the 400 micron. You see the stripes? That's exactly the same stripes. And what was spectacular with neutrons, we could really just see exactly the same size, what was estimated from Kerr microscopy. And then you clearly know, then you're dealing not with electronic effects, but with electrodynamics. So that's perhaps would be explained, like if you see the vertices and the vertices get bound, essentially the magnetization vector in each manganite layer would be rotating from this to that, and that's the sort of the area where the wall is located, and there's magnetization here is minimal, so the vertex perhaps gets bound to the wall, and so it gives you sort of like this. You got vertices, right? So this is the magnetic flux, right?
Yeah, but the origin, the source of these structures, is in manganite or in in YDCO or in
MangaNet? MangaNet at the interface. It's a MangaNet, but at the interface. It doesn't propagate through the whole material. A MangaNet, essentially what happens here, this has been shown actually in the single layer too. And if you look at the single layer MangaNet, you can induce similar pattern. And the way Vlaskov-Losov from Argonne has done this experiment. Essentially what happens, there is an octa to tetra transition, and essentially that structural transition triggers the magnetization to be bound in a certain stripe pattern. That's what was the
structure or simply a domain pattern, maybe the stripe domain.
Structure induces this. No, structure induces this electromagnetic transition into the stripe pattern in ultra thin films of manganites. That's essentially what's the explanation. There is a structural phase transition to tetra, the tetragonal. So it lowers the transition essentially. That actually been studied quite a bit, you know, recently. So I could show you some publications about that. Right. We didn't know either before we started sort of seeing this pattern. We found something new, but apparently that's been done already, this kind of investigation on single-layer manganites, LCMO. Okay, so then we decided to move the resonance of X-ray spectroscopy, which is, I'll dedicate the rest of my talk to that. I'm going to skip that, but except I'm putting it here just to say, and here in the United States, there is a wonderful facility. It's a third-generation synchrotron, but that's not enough to have only third-generation synchrotron. You can go to Israel and other places to find the same machine. What's important is that the user's instrument they use in there, they complete and very easy to use for an experienced user. So what they can measure there is they can tune your X-ray between 500 eV to 3 kV. Now, this is what's called the soft X-ray range. And what's special about the soft X-ray range, it actually covers the resonant, the L3 and L2 edges and majority of 3D transition metals. And even, you know, if you're lucky enough, you can reach even ruthenium, which is 2.8 something. But that's at the very end of the range. So it's quite a unique facility, and as I say, this was important. Another important factor, you can have both very quickly. This is things designed, the whole beam line is designed in Novosibirsk from Russia. They designed really unique facility, which allows you very easily to switch between linear polarization, vertical and horizontal, and circular, left and right. It's almost like in a matter of like a minute. In other facilities, you will be given only one. They will say, we'll give you horizontal. Or circular one polarization. So it's quite sort of unique what they got in there.
It's an Argonne, yes.
It's the line for IDC, and the instrument scientist is John Freeland, which is listed, was listed in the beginning. So that's where I spend most of my time sort of working on that, the materials. And what do we measure? We can measure there, we can measure what's known as a magnetic circular dichroism, and we also could look at the magnetic scattering. The resonant magnetic scattering. So I'll be referring to XMCD and XRMS. Okay, so the instrument-wise, what we probe, and that's important because that sort of proves what we're doing, we could probe really different depth. So the magnetism and structure, we could look at the at the same time, all three instruments, all three detectors look at the same sample at the same time. So this is the sample, that's our material. We shine the X-ray beam, let's say with left and right polarization, I plus, I minus. And we apply external magnetic field up to 7 Tesla. And what we measure is the electron yield. Essentially, this is the current from all sorts of electrons. And that's a very, very simple thing to do. Essentially, what you do, you touch here the piece of wire, you ground it, and put some picometer and measure some current. Okay. So that, of course, is clearly, you cannot pull out this photoelectrons from deeper than 20 nanometers. And that's what we call surface-sensitive absorption. Also, we can measure, of course, reflectivity, which goes a little bit deeper. And we also can look at the read throughout the whole sample and get information in the fluorescence field. Those are fluorescence photons. They come from very deep, so it's 20 nanometers. This is not correct. This 29. This is perhaps limited to 100 angstrom, so it's 10 nanometers. Okay, so what's important here is if you take the sum of these two signals, you measure through each of these detectors, at the certain, and you scan the energy, then you match the atomic layer level distance, and then essentially observe the phonon, and it takes you to some unoccupied states above Fermi level. So you probe the density of states above the Fermi level. So if you take the sum of those things, then it will give you information about chemical structure. This is enhanced because you really perfectly match some transition rate, and this is the L3 edge in the manganese. Now, if I keep scanning and I reach, say, for example, 930 eV, then I could be probing copper and so on and so forth. So what does it give me? It gives me a lot of chemical sensitivity. In other words, I can take the sample apart and study by tuning to the resonance edge and say what this chemical element is doing electronically and structurally inside the whole sample. Because the contribution from other chemical elements will be only like a few percent here. So that's the advantage of resonant enhancement. Now, if you take the difference will be proportional to the magnetization, uncompensated magnetic moment. Okay? And that's known as XMCD. And you know it from magneto-optics, right? So if you take some piece of material, you apply a magnetic field, you shine some light with left polarization or right polarization, the difference is that's what we do, but in X-ray regime. So this is, if you see something like this, then you would know there is uncompensated magnetic moment inside your sample at that particular chemical element. Yes, please.
Isn't there some many physics involved, like exciton effects? I mean, you
absolutely.
Can't directly say it's interband joint density of states. There's a final state interaction between the electron and the...
That's why you see it here. Well, you see that? That's how it looks like, right? So otherwise, it would be one sharp delta line. Exactly. So there's a multiplex splitting effect, of course, absolutely. And it's a strongly excitonic, actually. Core-hole interaction is absolutely dominant here. Okay? So, yeah, otherwise, it's correct. It will be just one sharp line, which is not the case. It's clear. So they're all present. And that's what sort of complicates the analysis, of course. But the fact is, if you see the... XMCD, then it's an important indicator to get manganese. So here's the example. We just take our manganite YBCO layer, super lattice, and we tune to the manganese edge, and of course you see XMCD, but we know manganese is ferromagnetic, right? So that sort of shows that it's really present there. Now, if you tune to copper, there is a D9 configuration, right? So there is not much really available there in density of states. Then you see the much sharper line here. This is, again, L3 edge on copper, and it's about 930. So we've done it, and we discovered that the line shape and the multiplet splitting, they're all compatible with what people find in bulk if you use one of this, the fluorescence, you'll say, for example, probes. Now, so let's do this exercise on the particular superlattice of an interest. So again, this is manganese, and you can see this multiplet splitting, and it clearly shows that's a very high-quality superlattice, because if you have oxygen deficiency, you generate not only manganese 3+, 4+, like in the normal manganite, you also get manganese 2+. That will be peaked right here, popping up. Okay, so we are quite pleased that we don't see anything like that. And of course, there is a very strong XMCD signal, about 40% here, which is compatible, consistent with the expected what you find in the bulk manganites. Then you do the same thing on copper, of course, and that's the absorption on copper. Okay, but here's the biggest surprise, right? So this is the XMCD on copper. And we know the copper, we did a lot of study of that, the copper is present inside the YBCO, so it's a layer, there are no like inclusion of copper or anything. And you see XMCD, but XMCD is a signature of uncompensated magnetic moment. So what we see here is the fact that the copper here carries magnetic moment. It's just very small, it's multiplied by a factor of 10, and yet it's a very distinct signal. Now, another observation you could make, if you apply field and you do measurement on this edge and at that edge, you see the sign at the same direction of magnetic moment that points down, this points up. So this thing is anti-aligned with that at the same direction of magnetic field. So we know that this magnetic moment and that magnetic moment, they are anti-aligned. So first of all, we're quite impressed that we find this finely magnetic moment on copper. And the second thing, we can conclude this anti-alignment. And that thing, by the way, is done in superconducting state, in 30 Kelvin. That's the lowest temperature we can reach in ultra-high vacuum. Okay, so how strongly they coupled? So we started, actually, the evolution of the XMCD signal as a function of temperature. So a lot of measurements. And the red line, this is copper, rescaled, of course. I just specifically rescaled it to superimpose on manganese. And they track perfectly each other. So there is extremely strong coupling. Essentially, the copper moment does exactly what manganese tells it to do. And this is as opposed to squid. This is squid, sort of superimposed on that. If you find that that's sort of like not quite a positive proof, we could actually do the hysteresis loops at particular edges. And this is the hysteresis loop. This manganese has a strong signal, so it's a nice hysteresis loop. And this is the same hysteresis loop on copper. And you can actually see they really track each other. And that's a real sign of ferromagnetism. If you see hysteresis loop, it's hard to argue with that. Okay, so we determined that there is a magnetic moment, they anti-align, and they're strongly coupled.
It looks like it tipped it or like sitting on the side.
No, because the... This is because the quality of that. You understand the copper magnetic moment is tiny, right? So that's why it takes about 300 scans, actually, to make one of those. It's an angle in that. Because it's not fully saturated, we cannot drive the magnet higher than that. So if you see that, you see there is a sort of tilt, right, in this direction. So it doesn't go like this. Okay, so the question was, where's the magnetic moment, right, in YBCO? So we did the interface sensitive mode with XRMS, reflected magnetic scattering. And we did the bulk sensitive mode in fluorescent sealed, and we know that the bulk clearly shows that this thing gets suppressed and much higher at the interface. So the signal really comes from...
How do you discriminate the bulk and
interface? The fluorescent sealed versus magnetic scattering. Okay. Now, but the true confirmation came from the neutron scattering. We did reflectivity in speculum mode. And what people do there, they essentially shine the X-rays and the neutron in, neutron out at the same angle, at the same plane. So it's a specular scattering. And they look at the interfaces. And what they do then, once they get intensity, they could model it. Like it's like diffraction, essentially. You have to put model and reverse it back. If you can describe the profile. And the only profile which really fits the intensity, the reflected intensity of neutrons was this. So this is the magnetization, this is the C direction, this magnetization, and this is magnetization inside the sample. Then it gets down at the interface, still finite though, and then the magnetization here is negative. Okay, very, very quickly, almost exponentially drops within 10, 15 angstrom. Nothing is inside YBCO, no uncompensated moment inside YBCO. Again, it rises here at the interface and quickly just switch the sign in the manganite layer. So we have two effects, suppression of magnetization at the interface in the manganite layer, and then another effect is the magnetic moment at the interface. That's what neutrons showed us, and we published in 2005 this paper, where we did detailed analysis and description. So those two measurements with X-rays and neutrons, they confirm that the magnetic moment is confined here. Yeah, it is. But we in 30 Kelvin, we measure the bulk, right? So now the question is, of course, very good. Is the interface superconducting, right? Is that what you're trying to say?
Or if you go to 100 Kelvin.
Yeah, yeah, this phenomenon disappears. You know, we know that this effect will disappear. Yeah, the magnetization is clearly is induced as long as the manganite ferromagnetic. We did the full temperature scan.
Manganite ferromagnetic, but where is your normal state?
Then you still see a magnetic moment.
Okay.
So, but how the magnetic moment is created here? And that's the most, I would say, whenever you try to speak to your experimentalists doing the interfacial physics, please ask this question. What do you know about the chemical structure of the interface? This turned out to be crucial and we're learning more and more. This information is really critical. Because by looking only at TAM like this, see, this is the really like 4 nanometer scale, and the interface is fantastically coherent. And if you show it to anybody, they will just claim, okay, well, this is your YBCO, we sell CMO, why wouldn't go and calculate something for me? Please don't do it, you know? Because here is the answer. So Maria Varela has done this work from Oakridge, and she looked at this interface and then did some measurements on EELs trying to determine what really at the interface, how to break. And then there is a group from ULIF that done the same work, which confirmed the chemical structure is correct. That's what we're dealing with. The result is as follows. I'm just really showing the chemical structure at the interface. If I naively look at this and I try to depict one unit cell of YBCO, which is made of chains, remember that? There will be a plane, then the yttrium in the middle, plane, and the chains, right? And AB direction, in the B direction. Okay, that's not correct. And of course, the manganite is a planar structure. That is not correct, because that's what will turn out, and I'll sort of try to explain it in simple terms. What's missing here, it's turned out, at the interface are chains. Chains are completely gone. And the chains, of course, charge reservoir, right? But the chains at the interface are missing on one side. Of course, on the other side, they're present. So if you ask me what it is, I say, I don't know, because in nature, you cannot fabricate like 2/3 of a unit cell to tell what it is. But that's what it is, and given that the charge reservoir like chains are missing, you would presume there should be strong suppression of superconductivity, or some effects of that. But that's what happens in it's really a true picture of the interface, and it's of course, even though you look at the perfect chemical structure, the real atomic positions are important here. So if you look even closer in this picture, this is copper oxide plane. What makes really interesting story is that the manganate here would be sitting right across of copper, which is in plane, so this is copper oxide plane, this is manganese plane, and they link through the oxygen. So it's like a perfect puff. Okay. Now, to give you some argument why chains are missing, it's very easy to understand for people who grow in the materials. Imagine yourself, you grow in a planar structure, which is a manganite, right? So there is one layer of manganite, another layer of manganite, and then all of a sudden, you try to grow chains, which is, of course, not planar structure. What happens is thermodynamically, it's a very unfavorable thing for nature to grow. What it does, it just strips them. Those atoms thermonucleate. And what it does, it continues growing with the planar structure, which is barium oxide. So, which is absolutely fine. That's why the chains are gone. And as a matter of fact, we found that the same structure present in the strontium ruthenate and YBCO interface. If we take strontium ruthenate and put YBCO on that, again, chains will be missing. That's been done in ULIC with TM work. So that was a really sort of a very important moment when we understood chemical structure. Now we could try to understand what's going on electronically. So this is sort of a standard information that how the copper oxide plane would look like.
So when you say the chains and the thing, is it not just sort of starting from the barium oxide layer when you go to the other side of the interface?
Just a moment.
It's not so much chain meeting, but rather just... the interface goes through barium oxygen
layer. And then the YBCO has everything in the right order from that. So
this part is missing.
But isn't it just that you're starting from one layer above that when you start?
But that's the chains, right? That's what's not symmetric in this picture, what replaces this part, right, is this.
Simply you cut this YBCO by the upper barium oxygen layer.
You can say it that way too, yeah.
And then when I go up from that upper barium oxide layer, everything's in the right order.
Everything is fine.
Yeah, then it'll be everything good to
be. Yes. So. What you didn't choose, that's what nature chose to strike. I wish I could choose where to start, but that's what.
Any reason why I should have expected it to start from the other barium oxide layer?
I mean, going like that?
Yeah.
But that's. No, that structure is not present. That's what has been investigated. It's possible. It was a possibility. They didn't find it present during growth. Maybe if MBE people would ever grow this structure, they would have something different, right?
So. Much energetically.
Energetically. Right. It's it needs to be calculated, essentially.
But you're thinking it goes from the MnO2 plane straight to the copper oxygen chains?
We know that. We don't think. That's what Eales shows, you know. They actually can tell the position of atoms as they go through the interface.
So you know they don't get that.
They know that this is exactly the configuration which is.
My question is, I guess, why we. It sounds like you were surprised by that, or.
I was surprised that was not the whole unit cell essentially present at the interface. Then to me it would be very spectacular. Then you observe magnetic moment in the complete unit cell, right?
What do they call unit cell? So you can start unit cell.
Well, this is the conventional sort of understanding of unit cell: two chains, two planes, and is.
That means you can choose unit cell starting just from this deep bivalent layer. That would be your unit cell.
So I don't see that there's anything missing when you say the chains are missing. They just come later in the stacking sequence.
Not quite, because imagine every other unit cell will be having those two chains, copper oxide plane, yttrium, copper oxide plane, two chains.
No,
except for this.
I start unit cell from zero baseline. That will be the beginning of my YBCO unit cell. You contain bivalent layer, then two CO2 layers, and then chain layer.
I'm not sure if that thing will superconduct, you know, in the way you're presenting it. You know, it needs to have two sources of reservoir. That's what typically conventionally considered to be unit cell, because you cannot just simply strip them out.
No, that's a different question. Yeah, your lowest CO2 layer which is in contact with CMO, but not in contact with chain layer. Rather, this lowest CO2 layer is dissolved in a proper way. So, probably it should. Then maybe that's why it's magnetic. Yes.
I'll explain why it's magnetic. We know why it's magnetic now. I'll explain it at the end.
Yeah, but I can also say that it comes off. Just because there is no chain reservoir to not to this one. In bulk, there should be, say, take fuel from bottom copper to layer. Copper to layer. And then in bulk, it should be yet one more chain layer below it. And here I have. Let's say mobile, instead. And so that's why this your CO2 layer, you may use it, it's not
bad. You can assume that. But.
Then it could be magnetic.
Well, it's not automatic. Let's see.
Not automatically, the direct from it may be wrong.
That's right. You will get wrong direction if
but
you assume automatically.
But it will be in the sense that it will be very susceptible to become a magnetic.
But the next layer, the next layer up, if I kept going,
actually,
I
would like to hear what you
the next layer will be made of. Okay, if you don't mind, I could use the board, right? So let me just. Can you see it from there? So this is what allow me to use this word conventional. Structure look like. Maybe I'm drawing the direction of the chain set wrong, but this is what I would consider that. So what's gone here at the interface is this, but then this part will continue on.
So you just start at the spot of the unit.
So every other will be like that, except when you reach the other interface, right? That unit cell will be, we call this incomplete. Okay, so that's very important, because every time if you naively assume the structure of the interface, it needs to be verified really experimentally, because the growth may give you a different chemical structure from what you think. Okay, so that's essentially what we're looking at now is the interfacial magnetic structure. This is manganite, this is the copper oxide, and then there is a, of course, path to between those two. And what would be coupling here? So we know that the manganese is supposed to be double exchange plus some backgrounds. Antiferromagnetism should be ferromagnetic. The copper-copper, it's a copper oxide plane, also should be antiferromagnetic here. The question is, why is this antiferromagnetic coupling? Now, of course, in true spirit, you should start going to good enough Connemara rules to really understand what's going on, and that's what we do. So, so allow me to overlap those orbitals and see if I want to get antiferromagnetic coupling, I need something like this. And is it doable? So here is the will be full in the normal YBCO. In a manganite, I presume it's in disordered state, orbital disordered state. So I'll assume it's 1/3 full. But then it doesn't work too well, because then I will break these rules, because I need to be ferromagnetic here. And then it should hint that your naive understanding what happens to the orbitals at the interface perhaps is not quite correct, and it should hint about some changes in orbital occupancy. So in the first paper we published, we were living under such a dogma that copper oxide plane is so robust, as antiferromagnetism, that plane is so robust, that perhaps what really reconstructs is a manganite. So it was much more easier to imagine that, you know, one of those three orbitals, they would sort of will be quenched into the planar structure, electrostatically planar at the interface.
Wait a minute. There exists a random fluorate, but there exists also potassium copper fluorate.
Yes.
Potassium 2 Cu F2. C2CuF2, which is perfectly ferromagnetic copper plane.
Potassium 2K2CuF. I don't know that. I know the orbital ordered one, potassium copper fluorate 3.
That's actually even bulk ferromagnetic. Transparent bulk ferromagnetic.
That's potassium 2, right?
Yeah.
Because the other one is not.
No, the other one is...
It's an insulator, I don't think. Yes. It's highly one-dimensional. That's right.
But in any case, CO2 planes are ferromagnetic.
Ferromagnetic, okay.
And this...
But okay. But, that's... Well, this is different material, right? Yeah. We actually have now the answer to that. Maybe I'll continue on the recent result, what we have. So that was very interesting to us, to look at how is it possible. And I remember, Daniel was trying to sort of put his understanding, like a diagonal sort of coupling, and Genyat Kalyulin would be proposing something else. But we decided to investigate it a bit further. And so the model we had in the previous publication was like that. We actually have a quantit antiferromagnetic state. So this is really almost the true model we were putting. If we assume the direct coupling here, then the easiest way to have induced magnetic moment, the small induced magnetic moment, is to assume that there is a quantit state in the antiferromagnetic copper oxide plane. And that sort of was the most straightforward explanation. With the small quantum, you can explain the small induced magnetic moment, and that's why they're so much driven by the manganese, and why it's so strong. The true understanding, of course, came later. As early as in June, I went to Argonne again, and I decided to look at the orbital symmetry at the interface. We use linearly polarized light. And I explained to you why this is so important. Because this idea came from much of course early publication, which was sort of, to me, as a spectroscopist, would be breakthrough. Because C.T. Chen showed that lanthanum, strontium, copper, lanthanum cuprate would be having the whole symmetry as x squared minus y squared. And the experiment was extremely elegant, because what he's done, he used the light, linearly polarized light, like this, like that. This is from his paper. We could go in some calculation to show why the intensity is like that, but let me just put very naive sort of picture. It's a good image, essentially. Think about this, the polarization vector and the orbital symmetry as a searchlight. You know, the polarization vector is a searchlight. So whenever you have a lot of polarization vector crossing a lot of orbital, then you will have high absorption. And if the polarization is like this, and the orbital is planar, then obviously you don't have much of a projection on this orbital, which is not quite correct, as I'm saying. You could develop some rigorous theory about that. But then you will see some reduced symmetry. So if we had z squared minus y squared, it would be opposite, of course. So here it was the positive proof. They used the light like this, linear light like this in plane, and you see enormous intensity. This is L3 peak, L2 peak, the copper edge. And then they, of course, switch polarization to vertical, and as you can see, the intensity become extremely suppressed. Which was the first, I would say, to me, like definitive proof about the orbital symmetry in the cuprates. Okay. So that was the motivation why we decided to look at the linear light. We decided to look at the symmetry. The problem is we're not studying bulk. So the problem is how to study the same thing by using only the light with the interface. So the idea is simple. Again, we're doing the same thing, vertical, horizontal light, and we want to shine on the interface. People done it actually in bulk, and what they observe is two facts. It's exactly confirms in YBCO, bulk YBCO. You see the very large intensity when the orbital is x squared minus y squared, and there's no intensity when you shine the polarization like this vertically, and the horizontal polarization is very high. Another important observation, there is no L3 peak position shift as a function of doping. And actually, that's what told people a lot, that the hole is actually not sitting on copper, it sits a lot on oxygen. There is a huge hybridization, right? That was the why there is no chemical shift here. Those are two important observations about YBCO. At that time, I was preparing samples for the photoemission, and to me, it was very important, how can you study photoemission, resonant photoemission? And then it occurred to me that we could do exactly the same thing with the... with our samples in absorptions, linear absorption spectroscopy. So what we've done is, I'd like to sort of spend 3 seconds. We'd like to study this interface. Essentially, this is the cluster we'd like to look at. This is manganese copper O10 cluster at the interface. And what we'd like to do, we'd like to use linear light, but make sure we study only interface. Not the bulk, not the top layer, not much in the below, but really at the interface. How we do it? For that purpose, I put really thick cup layer, about 100 angstrom here, YBCO, and this is manganite. And if I shine line here, and I try to pull out these photoelectrons, then obviously that light, the photoelectrons from a deeper layer right here, from deeper manganite layer and the manganese ridge, they wouldn't really pull out because there is a very, very few photoelectrons which would survive on the very tail. So this is exponentially suppressed, right? So you cannot get photoelectrons deeper than 100 angstrom. So, and I put 100 angstrom. And if you can get any photoelectrons, you know they're coming from the very, very top of this manganese layer, which is the interface. If I want to do exactly the same thing with copper, I will grow manganite on the top and try to pull out photoelectrons off the copper with very thick cup layer. So what it guarantees to me that a lot of spectral weight will come from the interface in very little, because there's really very few photoelectrons left. So that gives you enormous sort of weight into the interfacial photoelectrons. So yes, the spectroscopy is still statistical, but the spectral weight is enormously weighted by this interface. So that was the idea. How can we make interface sensitive? Resonance spectroscopy. So with that resonance spectroscopy, the resonant here is very important because you tune to the different edges. You know you study different layers. So we done the samples and I took it to Argon and we started, John Fernand and I, we started looking at stuff with linear light. And here is this sort of thing I would like to share with you. We use this. This is the bulk sensitive mode. So we're looking through many, many interfaces. So first of what you observe here is the line shape is like this, which is normal. Nothing particularly unusual. That's what people see in the bulk. You see a lot of enhancement when you shine the light in the plane, and very little intensity when you go in AB plane. So that's how what Si-Chi Chen showed to us.
Copper resonance?
It's a copper resonance, 932. Yes, it's all. Everything we'll be talking about now will be about copper resonance. So we're looking only at the copper. So this is the copper from the bulk of YBCO. And it's normal. You know, it behaves as expected. Now, I'm going into the interface sensitive mode. So we're doing this trick with the two different samples, putting cup and layers. And the first observation I would like to see is quite striking. You will see the intensity in both polarization is equal. It's almost like isotropic. The second very important observation is the peak position. The peak position on the copper gets shifted with respect to the normal copper. Okay. And again, it's the copper edge. That's what the interface looked like. And the shape itself becomes much more symmetric. So we instantly sort of violated the major rules of how YBCO is supposed to look like with the linear light. First of all, we see the shift, the chemical shift in the position on the copper. And the second thing, the absorption become isotropic. It means that the whole is not an x squared minus y squared symmetry anymore. Not only. There's quite substantial contribution here from z squared orbital. Now, if you take reference compounds and try to estimate by looking at the magnitude of the shift in energy scale, by converting them into the electrons, how much you really do the charge transfer because of the chemical shift, you would find that the electrons, because you can always look at the direction where they go, the electrons move from manganite layer into the YBCO layer, so you're doing electron doping into YBCO across the interface by about 0.2 electron per copper. And the second fact is that now the orbital symmetry is dramatically different. But what causes this orbital reconstruction? That was the major question. So this is the interfacial structure, and we have to now discuss what could happen at the interface, why this orbital symmetry or orbital reconstruction does occur first. First of all, of course, anybody who sits in this room, they will say, okay, you can rearrange actually your levels, z squared versus x squared minus y squared, by simply shifting the position of apical oxygen. Right? That's sort of a very, very good thing to start with. So could it be that the apical oxygen essentially shifted and creates this orbital occupancy? So that's how it would look in the bulk, except here we're just replacing this chain, copper, by manganese. And so we say no by several reasons. The reason number one is that first it really takes, there is a large difference between these energy levels in the bulk. And in order to reoccupy that, it really would take some massive rearrangement of this distance. In other words, you have to squash it down here. This oxygen should be moving down there, which is like very different from what you find in the bulk, and it takes a lot of energy. But the second most important fact is that you're replacing this copper one by the formal ion valency 3.3 plus, this manganese, which actually does totally opposite thing from what you imagine. It actually would lower Z square, not to increase it. Okay? So those two factors actually do work again against this sort of understanding. We can't rule out like completely 100%, of course. There would be maybe some specific position of oxygen which perhaps would give some strange massive rearrangement of the ligands. But at the moment, it doesn't look reasonable, and it's been calculated as well. So,
can you check whether there is some reconstruction, some shift in the lateral direction in copper two plane, the layer?
The answer is no, unfortunately, Daniel. We look at very carefully at TEM, if we could pull out something out of that. The resolution is too crude for this kind of information. It's more like a guesswork.
You could take at least, you might again, this analogy to this potassium to copper fluoride. because then it actually standard magma cuprates, this tetrahedra, all are elongated along the XI minus pressure 4 orbital. All tetrahedra, if they are just elongated along this. In potassium cuprates, they are elongated but lying like this.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So that orbital will be, say, Andromedic node, X minus hydra,
quite. Is that orbital ordered? This potassium too. Yeah. Okay.
And that's I think that it might be very close to the same situation. So the first layer may be hit very similar to what it does in potassium too. But then it could give you some kind of distortion, some kind of superstructure. It may not change the unit cell because it's already accommodated, already looks very big. But it will be some extra distortion in the data fluid, so in later phase. So you cannot really check it.
We cannot tell within the unit cell the positions of atoms. We cannot say with that precision, sort of, if it's distorted that much.
Potassium is actually one of the most sensitive tools for what is NMR. NMR in this case it was NMR on fluorine. Mm-hmm. That tells you that indeed in plain fluorine are not sitting exactly in the middle between copper, but rather close to one copper.
Well, yeah. If you do NMR here, if you look at this, doing NMR here, you're looking only at the interface. Everything will be dominated by bulk. That's the problem. Yes. Okay. So the interface electronic structure. Now I'm stepping into this third area where is the theory. Okay. So we asked Michel Van Andel to calculate for us the first of all absorption rates. But the most important question was, is it possible somehow to model this copper manganese O10 cluster which occurs at the interface within the cluster calculation with exact diangulation by playing with the parameters? It's essentially a single orbital model, which you could find in the bulk, and tune several things to produce reoccupation, these orbitals, it's number one, and secondly, to replicate this chemical shift. So the result was quite interesting because what he's done, is my understanding, the major tuning parameter here is since x squared minus y squared and z squared, they essentially are orthogonal, so he would be representing the manganese by one, the only z squared orbital, which is strongly coupled to TG stuff. That's reasonable. The second thing what he's done, he introduced the on-site energy on manganese, which is essentially a way to tune the difference in work function, the way to push electrons through the interface. So that's a tunable parameter for you. The structure is taken, all the other numbers has been taken out of literature and essentially early work in 1990 from PRL with Zawadzki and collaborators, all other numbers. If somebody is interested, I could show what the other parameters are. On the cuprate side. So as you can, we'll start here. Essentially, this is the result of his cluster calculations. The other concept is, of course, to assume that there is a strong covalent bonding. So the copper oxygen manganese is the strongly covalently bond. And then what you do, you essentially watch when your bonding and antibonding energy, here's this very simple sort of model, they essentially, when the energy of antibonding state, how is it compared to the energy of the state on the copper with x squared minus y squared, where the hole is residing. And so what you tune on-site energy on the manganese. So if you start at the high on-site energy, so on this right-hand side, you can see that in this set of parameters, you always occupy copper with the normal hole, this is x squared minus y squared. And this is the number of holes on copper. And you see it's not one because you know it's strongly hybridized, like it should be. But then what you could imagine, once this antibonding level crosses this copper x squared minus y squared, there is this charge transfer transition here. When the this state, hybridized state, antibonding state has been occupied, and you can see that's the z squared orbital here. And of course, if you push it hard enough, then you fill up completely z squared, x squared minus y squared, and you have a little bit of filling on the copper side with z squared. So you can actually just go to this side. So that's what the theory showed, that essentially by tuning the charge transfer, the work function through the interface, you can end up with the reoccupation of orbitals if you assume covalent bonding. So this covalent bonding also explains why you see this mixed state, x squared minus y squared, and moreover, it shows it tells you that there is a chemical shift, because now the bonded state, this one, is not really a subject to the Zangreis singlet formation, because it's in different symmetry. So that's why we observe chemical shift. So it's another strong indication. Then, of course, the antiferromagnetism is easily explained because Z squared is seriously occupied. So that's essentially the picture you would sort of picture yourself then, that would be antibonding state here, created state here. And this is the big magnetic moments, the antiferromagnetically coupled, something like that. So essentially what's happening here is the charge transfer is leading to hybridized state by the apical oxygens. And it's associated, of course, with orbital reconstruction at the same time. Well, so essentially I just said it, what you see here, I explained to you. And here's the job for theorists. One thing it should occur to you, why is it so abrupt and charged? Well, because the cluster, you got to use a single levels, right? There are no bonds there, bends are there. So there's a single level, they go in the cluster. Also, this bond is almost orthogonal to this state, and there is only small spin orbital mixing in there. That's why you have the presence of x squared and z squared, what you see experimentally. And also, you can see, you know, if you look at the extended system, because along the interface, you don't have only two atoms. It's not one cluster. It's actually the whole set of atoms. It's extended system. Okay, so then I have to start thinking in terms of bands. Okay, that's so essentially the clear, the ab initio stuff would require, if it's possible at all here, because the unit cell is very complex and the symmetry is really broken here. So it would be hard perhaps to do. But that's sort of our dream to encourage you. And I'll skip what's next. We have everybody's sort of. Looking at what's next. We worked a lot on the proximity effect, how the superconductivity leaks into ferromagnet. We didn't find it yet. So we had a publication saying we put the limit on the leakage of copper pairs into ferromagnetic layer. It's the same system. Yeah, it's the same. What we're working on now on the calcium and praseodymium doping, we want to see how the doping on the YBCO, when you go across the dome diagram, the dome-shaped diagram, what does it do to the physics. And we now started working on different ferromagnets, like strontium, ruthenite, and bisco. That's sort of really very interesting. So I'm pleased to sort of tell that I think now we have sort of the understanding that there are like several layers of reconstructions that can occur in the interface, like lattice reconstruction, electronic reconstruction, and finally the orbital reconstruction. So if you would like to read more about that, so those are publications, and we're expecting this results will be on Science Express within a couple of weeks. So. The orbital stuff. All right, so thank you very much.
Can you say if you work actually about some other things you mentioned at the beginning?
We could go through that. Yes, and
Yes, it is. Because wasn't there some uncertainty about that stuff?
Which one? I would say it's Cantita and determinant.
Yeah.
That would be what it is.
Excuse me. Perhaps we could consider.
Could you just briefly say what remains from the exchange then in the qubits? Now you've talked about this cluster model at the interface. Now
yes.
If you go into the plane in the qubit. So what is the exchange in there?
The exchange essentially gets modified, right? And right at the interface, the unit cell is essentially, it's not like chemically isolated thing what you're used to. It's a bound state, right? It's a covalent bond in between manganese, oxygen, and copper.
But if you consider one layer of the manganese and one layer of the cuprid now, is it still a frustrated system at the interface if you go from the manganese to the copper and back, or what about the exchange in the qubit itself?
The original understanding holds true. So now we have, because Z squared filled up, right, you have very strong coupling here, which is antiferromagnetic, because Z squared, they're both present, it's a direct ball. So good enough condomer is satisfied. This antiferromagnetism still survives, of course, in the plane.
Yes.
Yes, in plane. So the magnetism remains like what we've seen before.
Okay.
I'm not sure that it's direct, actually.
Well, it does, right? The previous work shows that the magnetic moment does exist there, right? So.
No, it does exist there, but whether copper is indeed antiferromagnetic in the copper itself, adjacent to magnetism. Do you know that what is the coupling in between coppers in this third layer?
No, I can't rule it out, right? So but if it's modified, then it's not.
That's a question.
The problem is the moment on copper is still tiny. You have to understand that there is a very tiny moment, right? So how much of the interaction this super exchange has been changed? That's not much. Because it didn't really bring a lot of magnetic moment. It's about 0.1 mV. That's what it is. So the Cantin would be more natural thing to think of than something else. The antiferromagnetism generally is a very robust thing, right? Its accessibility is very low, so it's hard to do anything with that.
What about the first manganese layer? Is it fully magnetized or reduced?
It's reduced. It's reduced because it pushes the hole. Yeah, essentially it's very interesting, and I skipped it on purpose. Actually, we've done, of course, on the manganese part the same investigation, right? And we see that the charge has been really truly transferred in different directions. So it's a hole doping into the manganese side, which takes you closer to the 1/2 doping, right? Which is charge order phase. So that's why magnetization perhaps gets reduced. And reoccupation of orbital does occur in there too.
To what extent have people done the routine density function tower calculation? I know there's a lady, Mrs. Tencheva in Munich, and she did some work on this. And from this you can construct the reasonable input into Hubbard type of or whatever orbital models concerning at least the hopping parameters. So my question is, to what extent in your materials is there knowledge from the density function of LDA type of fields?
I don't know. I think George Zawadzki would be the right person to answer this kind of thing. We talked to Warren Pickett, right, and the ladies he's collaborated. I don't think they're doing this kind of complexity unit cells yet.
The problem is it's so hard to do a good DMT calculation for a magnetite on its own, getting the correct orbital and charge.
It's more like quantum chemistry to my sort of understanding what would help here most. And then you have to include Coulomb interaction should be tunable parameter here.
Yeah,
sure, but the usual way is that you believe you get from the LDA type of calculations the single particle hoppings at least roughly under control. And then on top of this, you then do unconstrained density functional calculations to get the Hubbard use. At least an estimate of that, again for the interface, and so I know people have done that. So the question is, these materials seem to be too difficult to do it from a chemistry point of view, or
A unit cell is too complex.
This is a very big system. And when you want to do this analysis, I mean, it's very computer.
So the answer is basically this is not yet available.
I mean, it is. I mean, Pencheva tries to do this kind of materials, but it's just a very complicated system, and it takes you months to really do an analysis out of that. So it's possible, but it's a long project.
I think when the publication will be out, there will be accompanying paper from Elbia Degada. He will be talking about what really takes to calculate it in more details. I don't want to sort of answer it. I know what I would answer, but I want you to read, because it's really sort of his work, and he's sort of trying to push certain directions in computational sort of way doing this. But his essential point is the DFT and quantum chemistry. That's what it would take.
And so Elbia has like a perspective on your...
Yes, he will be writing a perspective on that. At least that's what I know.
So, why don't we break for lunch and thank Jack again. We're going to be around the rest of the day and tomorrow as well for discussion in the office on the second floor.